Thank you very much, Lodge. And Tree Setillon sends his apologies. He's in his hotel room right now with a horrible case of laryngitis, and he really can't give the talk. However, I want to make a push for Tree. If anyone's in the market for an assistant professor who is one of the best young modelers in the world right now, who can develop incredibly dynamic, robust, innovative models, it's Tree Setillon, and please contact him or contact him through me. Of course, our co-authors, big group, and Jim Speck's here, Haishun Yang is here, Akam Doberman's in the Philippines. We're going to talk about genotype-specific coefficients, their evaluation, their application. This entire presentation is available online. So we're going to look at, just as an example, a corn and a soybean model a corn and soybean model that explicitly seek to have as few genotype-specific parameters possible. On the left, hybrid maize soy sim, and two where they use multiple genotype-specific parameters. All of these are published, available, and widely used in the U.S. Corn Belt. So they're all used. So in terms of the ones that use very few, hybrid maize, it's growing degree days to maturity. All seed companies have that. It's very in terms of soy sim, a soybean model, again, maturity group, all seed companies can provide that. And stem termination type, whether it's indeterminate or semi-determinate. Series maize uses at least six genotype-specific parameters, four to define phenology, two for seed fill, and crop grow soybean uses seven or eight or 15 in this case. That means for every genotype you use, every cultivar, one has to get these parameters. They're not available from seed companies, and only a few people know how to measure them, actually. They also run the risk that the key issue is, if you parameterize them for one environment, are they robust across a wide range of environments? And the implication here, especially for those of us interested in climate change, is if a cultivar's genotype-specific parameters are not stable across environments in today's climate, there's tremendous risk in using such models to predict future climate change. Going to go to this slide. And this shows, for instance, how Tree began the quest for getting a model with a minimum genotype-specific parameters. So on the very far left is a plot of observed phenology and simulated phenology, where seven coefficients are used for 20 cultivars in two locations over 2 years and four different treatments for each. And you see, when you use seven, and by the way, these coefficients were taken from the literature, a paper by Hesketh on the effect of temperature on phenology, and another paper I can't remember on seed dynamics, seed development dynamics, but it took seven, 20 cultivars, and you can get excellent congruence between observed and simulated phenology. Now, if you can only choose one cultivar's parameters, perhaps this is a maturity group in about the middle. These are maturity groups 1 to 4, by the way, of the 20 cultivars. The relationship starts falling apart, and you can see the plot of deviation from the regression of observed and simulated starts to show tremendous bias. And on the right is Soysim, where he was able to get relationships, empirical relationships, between maturity group and each of these phenology parameters and seed parameters. And you can see it does a pretty good job of simulating across years and treatments, and very little bias in the residual mean square. So the point is, with an explicit focus on trying to get to a point where you have minimum number of parameters, it looks like it's feasible. For hybrid maize, in this model developed by Haishun Yang here, who now works with Monsanto, to our sadness, we found that there was a very different relationship between growing degree days and days to maturity, which seed companies provide with the seed, and growing degree days to silking. There was an overall generic relationship shown in the blue there at the bottom of the plot itself, but there were slight nuances among companies. These are not real differences, it's just differences in the way the companies parameterize their measurements. But the point number one, you can get a generic relationship that's a pretty good fit overall. If you know what the company seed you're using, you can actually get a much tighter fit. And you can use one parameter to predict silking, growing degree days to maturity. So other coefficients, for instance, respiration and the photosynthetic parameters that describe photosynthesis, fortunately, are not genotype specific. So Tree then went on to validate, to look at how these models perform, ones with lots of coefficients and the ones with few, looking at soybean at the orange four sites there, and we have collaborators from Purdue, from Iowa State and Minnesota that helped us on this, and then corn in the green squares and both irrigated and rain-fed. And a wide range of planting dates, plant populations, a wide range of yields and observations. And the key here is that all of these are grown in environments where there's very few limitations. So these are grown under fairly near optimal conditions. Yield potential, we call it. We look then here for maize, and we see on your left a plot of simulated and observed for maize. And you see overall fairly good agreement. And the point here is that it's about what Jones and Canary got when they first published the series maize model. So we feel it's a pretty good indication how that model is performing over environments and sites. The hybrid maize model, and that's using six genotype-specific parameters. Hybrid maize model using the growing degree days does a pretty good job as well, and the bias is simulated versus observed is very stable across a wide range of yields. This is the simulations, similar set of simulations for soybean across those four locations. Soy sim on the right has a reasonable root mean square error, very nice mean error, very little bias across a wide range of environments. And again, this is with only specifying maturity group and whether it's a indeterminate or semi-determinate growth habit. The relationship for crop grow is very similar to what was published by Petterson and all for the upper Midwest. And I think the disconcerting thing there is the bias in the estimate relative to yield. So the ability to have very few genotype-specific input parameters that are those that are easily measured and widely available means these models can be used widely by lots of people, including researchers and producers and consultants. So here we're now moving the hybrid maize to estimating fertilizer requirements. This is initial, we call it hybrid maize N. This is an initial validation of that where we have data sets from western Nebraska, central Nebraska, eastern South Dakota. Data sets provided by David Clay at South Dakota, Darren Roberts and Richard Ferguson for eastern Nebraska, and Drew Lyon for western Nebraska. Seems to be doing pretty well. We're evaluating maize productivity and water use in western Nebraska. Benchmarking water productivity in maize seems to do a very good job there. Patricio Grassini reported that on a poster earlier this week. And soy seam is now being used for irrigated scheduling, and we're fortunate to have Jessica Torreon, who will tell us about those, the use, how that's being used for an irrigation scheduling tool in Nebraska. Climate change, I think, is the very interesting one. It seems that we're able to use these streamlined models with few genotype-specific parameters to get pretty close to what people are predicting happens under increasing CO2, at least, for soybean. Turns out one of the effects is higher harvest index with increasing CO2. The model's predicting that, and as well, the historical yield increase from CO2, that we're simulating about 6 kilograms per hectare per year. Jim Speck estimated it just based on assumptions about photosynthesis and carbon dioxide concentration at about 5 kilograms per hectare per year. So it seems these can also be quite robust for climate change evaluations. But I think the most promising thing is we're actually finding these models starting to be used widely by producers and crop consultants because the input parameters simply are so accessible. We're also finding it used in extension. So this past year, when USDA predicted record corn yields and the corn markets were thus very relatively low in price. And lo and behold, those empirical relationships they use in predicting yields were off, and yields were much lower than predicted. And Roger Elmore, who used to be at University of Nebraska, now at University of Iowa, runs a monthly newsletter about the corn crop in Iowa, and he was letting growers know ahead of time that it didn't look like yields were going to be record-breaking yields based on use of hybrid maize. It has an ability to predict real-time during the season, by the way, so you can predict up to any date during the season what the yield is likely to be at the end. It uses real-time data to the point when you do the simulation and historical weather data to finish the season, and then you get probability distributions. So in summary, genotype-specific inputs can be minimized in simulation models. It has to be an explicit goal from the outset. They give a robust simulation across a wide range of environments. Very stable, it appears. And because of that, we think they're very effective for use in decision support and in research, as I think particularly for climate change. And with that, Dr. Ahuja, we're going to end. So the question is, our colleague noted that there, for the two models we used as examples that have lots of genotype-specific parameters, there were 6 for maize and 15 for soya. It has to do with the complexity of flowering and growth and development. And so for maize, where you have one inflorescence and a pollination-shedding epoch period, it takes fewer genotype-specific parameters. But for a indeterminate plant like soybean that has many fruiting locations and is continually flowering, and it's much more, and it's photoperiod sensitive as well. And I'm going to direct you to my colleague Jim Speck if you would like to hear a lot more, because the soybean is a much more complicated beast when it comes to predicting phenology.
Yeah, I agree with you, Manu. The major limitation is determining the genotype coefficients.
Yes.
And if you really want to apply, you know, we spend a lot of time.
Exactly. Exactly. And both of these models are publicly available, by the way. Yeah. No. It was the other way around. It was how robust can models be when you explicitly try to reduce the number of coefficients. Okay. Pardon me?
It'd be nice if you could summarize that answer in one slide.
Well, it's really a competition against itself. What we wanted to do was to see if our model could how well it could do. And it met our objectives, and that's what we're interested in. Yep. Yes. So did everyone hear the question? So the question is that for a crop like maize, unlike soybean, indeterminate flowering habit, but for maize where you have a single inflorescence and a very short 2 or 3 day period of pollination, it's the unique events of heating or cooling at that period or drying that has such a large impact on yield. Well, it turns out that in favorable environments like the U.S. Corn Belt, those events are relatively rare, so our models do pretty well. So it begs the question, I guess the bottom line is, if we were to use this for much harsher climates, we would have to add a subroutine that looked at the impact on seed number at that particular point in time. But my guess is, again, if you started with the explicit goal of making it a generic parameter rather than a genotype-specific parameter, you could probably do that as well.
And that's the climate change challenge.
That's it. And Cynthia Rosenwig reminds us exactly, as you move, the prediction for climate change is not only change in temperature, but change in amplitude of events. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.